We're doing Parshat Emor. It's a new semester. Generally, our Parsha class aspires to encompass the laws of the Parsha, the mitzvot of the Parsha, some of the Jewish philosophy of the Parsha. And now we're up to Parshat Emor. Gentlemen, if you don't mind, when you're passing by, if you could go through the back. We have a video camera up there. We're beginning Parshat Emor. Parshat Emor begins with the mitzvot of the Kohanim. We know that of the Levites, of the tribe of Levi, so the descendants of Aaron were designated to serve in the temple, and they were given the title Kohanim. They have special mitzvot that they may not become spiritually defiled, what in Hebrew we call tamei. They may not come in contact with a dead person. They may not be in the same house under the same canopy with a dead person. They may not shade over. They may not be as a shade. They may not physically be above a corpse. Any one of those would impart upon them tum'ah. So that's why Kohanim, whose wives are giving birth, will try to go either to a hospital that does not deal with people who are dying, or which hospitals? There are hospitals dedicated for childbirth. Or Shaarei Tzedek has a sign, a notice, when there's a deceased body in the building, and then the Kohanim are asked to leave. So it's a good thing to have a mother-in-law to be there with your wife, right? So Kohanim are warned not to be in the building with a corpse. That's our parsha. But their immediate relatives, they must become defiled for. Their father, their mother, their son, their daughter, their brother, or their sister who's still a virgin who has never been wed. So for them, they go, they attend the funeral, and they do become tameh. They have a special mitzvah that goes beyond the ordinary mitzvah that everyone has. That everyone has a mitzvah that we're not supposed to shave our heads and shave off the payas over here, right? There's this new fad of getting this really close haircut. So aside from the question of whether that's permitted for other halachic reasons, because you're not supposed to dress like the non-Jews, right? And in Shulchan Aruch, one of the examples that the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch quotes is that the non-Jews used to cut their hair short on the side and leave a clump of hair in the middle. So that's an example that's actually quoted in Gemara and Talmud. So that's one question, but there's another question, and that is the mitzvah of peah. You're not supposed to shave off the corners of your hair. You're not supposed to shave them so close that you wouldn't have a hair long enough to fold it over on itself. So that's the corner of their head. And the corner of the beards, you're not supposed to shave off. And we're not sure exactly which bones. There are five corners on the face. We're not sure where they are. So on the corners of the beard, you're not allowed to shave them with a razor or the equivalent of a razor. So the Kohanim are given a repeat of those commandments. They're not allowed to shave their head and the corners of their beards. Maybe the priests of different cults used to shave those off. So the Kohanim have an added warning not to do that. They're supposed to be holy, and they're bringing the sacrifices. They have to be careful who they marry. Is anyone here a Kohen? No Kohanim. Okay, so it's easy to learn these halachot because it doesn't pressure anyone. So a Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorced woman. A Kohen is not allowed to marry a woman who has had intimate relations with someone that's prohibited to her. So let's say a woman grew up and she wasn't observant, and in her lifetime she's had intimate relations with a man who's not Jewish. That woman may not marry a Kohen. The term in the Torah is zona, which in other contexts means a woman of ill repute. But with regards to the Kohen, it means a woman who had relations with someone that's prohibited to her. So if she had relations with a man who was not Jewish, that's the most common, or with a bastard, with a mamzer, so then that woman would be disqualified from marrying a Kohen. If a Kohen does marry her, so then he is in transgression every day that he's married to her. He has a mitzvah to divorce her. He's not allowed to stay married to her. He cannot say, I love her and I'll forgo my kahuna. Doesn't work that way. Every day he's married to her, he's in transgression. And same if he'd marry a divorcee. And his children are chalalim. So his children would be disqualified kohanim. They would not be allowed to duchen. They would not be allowed to go up to bless Israel. They would not get the rights of kohanim in getting an aliyah as a kohen, and they actually would be permitted to marry the women that are prohibited on a kohen because they lost their stature. They became chalalim. In a minute, let's first go over the parsha, then we'll do questions. Okay, once we touched on the depths of these halachot, we'll add one more halacha that's super relevant, In Russia, Kohanim have a very hard time finding a shiduch because a Kohen is also prohibited from marrying a Jewish woman whose father is not Jewish. Even though in almost every other area of halacha, when the father is not Jewish and the mother is Jewish, the child is a kosher Jew. But this is one area where there is a residual effect, where her mother was Jewish, but her father was not, then that girl cannot marry a Kohen. And being that in Russia, many of the Jewish girls have a non-Jewish father, so Kohanim in Russia have a hard time finding a shidduch. They got to come to Israel. Okay, Yaakov, what were you asking? No. Loses it all. I didn't hear you. We'll get to Kohen Gadol.
So it's like he doesn't have a tribe? Like,
he's part of that tribe, but he's... correct. Vekidashto. So we have a mitzvah to honor a Kohen. We give them the first aliyah in shul. If we're making a blessing, we honor them with making the blessing. If we're going to honor someone else, then we ask their permission. So in things of holiness, we let the Kohen go first because he is our representative in bringing the sacrifices. We have the mitzvah of a Kohen Gadol. So the Kohen Gadol is the what we might translate as the high priest. He's the one who wears the special clothing and brings the special sacrifices. He gets anointed with special oil. So when he loses a relative, he does not become defiled for that relative. Even if it's a father or mother or sister or brother, he has to retain his holiness. His job as a representative of the masses precludes his leaving his post. He has to stay there in the temple doing his duties. And he's not allowed to become defiled for them.
Even his wife,
correct. He has to ensure that other people take care of the funeral and she gets the proper honor, but he himself would not be there. We have two opinions in the Mishnah as to what does it mean, umina mikdash lo yetze. Does it mean literally that the Kohen Gadol does not leave the temple at the time of the funeral? Or does it mean he shouldn't leave his state of holiness? He may leave the temple, but he always stays a corner behind the funeral procession. So he rounds the corner as he sees them rounding the next corner. He always stays one corner behind, so as to ensure he doesn't lose control, he doesn't defile himself in the funeral procession. So he has a commandment that he's only allowed to marry a virgin, a young woman who's never been married, whereas an ordinary Kohen may marry a widow, a Kohen Gadol may not marry a widow. Here we covered the mitzvot of a Kohen. The Kohen is called the Kohen HaGadol Me'achav. The high Kohen, the Kohen Gadol, is called the Kohen who is great from his brothers. So here our sages say, what does it mean? Does it mean he's greater than his brothers? Or, another interpretation is, his brothers make him great. And when a person would get the position of Kohen Gadol, every Kohen would put down some money so that the Kohen Gadol would be the wealthiest Kohen. They'd all put down some money in this general pot, so he became great from his brothers. His brothers would make him wealthy. It's interesting that historically, the Kohanim were a sect unto themselves, and they were an elitist sect, and they were a wealthy elitist sect. You would think they were poor because they didn't have agriculture, but somehow they were actually wealthy. Maybe they were good businessmen. I don't know. Okay, we're up to Sheni. Next, we have the commandment that the Kohanim who are blemished cannot serve as representatives, even though they might be fine kosher Jews. One of the leading rabbis, Rabbi Yoshua, had disgusting features. People would look at him and revel at what a disgusting creature he was. Yet he was a genius. He was chief rabbi, Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yosef was the chief rabbi, yet he was blind. Throughout our history, we had great men, Moshe Rabbeinu. No one could understand him. And yet he was the greatest orator, right? The greatest leader. Throughout our history, people who were blemished could have great positions. But in the temple, there's another concept. The temple is the place which unifies between Hashem and the Jewish people and humanity. And the question often is, how do you view that place? So it's like the question when you have to donate something, do you donate your best or your worst? It's a question of Cain and Hevel, right? Cain takes his worst animals for the sacrifice, and Hevel takes his best fruit. Right? The other way around. Cain takes his worst fruit and Hevel takes his best animals. I got it backwards. So in the temple, part of what we're doing is we're showing glory. We're showing that we value this relationship. So then the representatives have to be in kind. If you'd walk up to the temple and one priest was hobbling without a leg and another priest was working with three fingers, missing the other two, you'd feel like, okay, it's nice. We're giving jobs to people who are physically challenged. But you'd also feel like the temple is a place where it's not the highest quality people go to this line of work. There are positions like that. I'm not comfortable enumerating them. But even today, there are positions where if you have enough intellect and you have enough knowledge, you don't end up in those positions. Those positions are relegated for the people. It's like the doctors who get an F or a D. They pass with a 65. Where do they work at the end, right? Who gets that treatment? So you don't want to be in the ER on a summer afternoon, Friday afternoon, in the heat of the summer, right? Because the good doctors are out vacationing. Who gets to work on the weekends of the summer where everyone else wants to be on vacation? That's the worst time to be stuck in a hospital. So sometimes you get a good doctor. I'm not saying everyone there is bad. But, okay, there are times you don't want to, you need to do a surgery and you can plan it. Try to get it Monday, Tuesday. So that anything that has to happen, you're still getting the top staff of Wednesday, Thursday. But if you're going to do it Thursday and then you have to deal with the staff of Friday, Shabbos, it's questionable what kind of treatment you're going to get. So the temple has to be elite. When you come to the temple, you have to feel, wow, I'm coming to an awesome place. So the Torah gives us a special mitzvah. The Kohanim cannot be blemished. Even if a Kohen is missing the bridge of the nose. So he looks funny. But you're going to walk home and you're going to remember, ah, yeah, when I got to the temple, I saw that funny looking Kohen. Torah gives us a mitzvah. No, he cannot serve up there. He can do other things. In the temple, the representative have to leave you with a feeling, I came to a temple, a place of glory. And so in the temple, we also have the concept, en aniyut min kom ashirut. It's a place of wealth. You shouldn't have poverty there. Things have to be done in a regal manner. The Navi laments that in the times of the first temple, people would take any animal that was blemished. V'chi takrivu. And when you bring piseach, you bring the animal that's crippled, they'd come up to the temple, here, I got an animal for you. Right? They'd bring the iver, they'd bring the animal that was blind. That's the animal they brought as sacrifices. Hashem asked them, hakriveu na lefechatecha. Go bring that animal to your local governor. Hayirtzechau ha'isaf anecha. Do you think he'll like you then? So why are you bringing me those sacrifices? And that teaches us a concept. Hakriveu na lefechatecha is a halachic concept. Would you offer that to your local governor? Well, that's the question. And so we have these mitzvot that the Kohen cannot be blemished. Blemished people are wonderful. I have a blemish. A lot of people have blemishes, right? But you know what? You have to recognize that in that task, in that field, people have to walk away with the right feeling, and you're representing Hashem. So a person who has a broken arm, you know, I broke my arm, this arm, the doctor never fixed it. He never set it straight. So you see the hump in my arm, right? So my arm can bend in ways other people can't bend their arms. It's not the only thing that's wrong with me, right? In the temple, you had to be a representative. So you couldn't look funny. You had to be without blemishes. So the Torah lists blemishes, and we consider them as prototypes, and they have toladot. There are offshoots that the Mishnah enumerates. Those are the Kohanim who have other rights and other responsibilities, but they don't belong in the temple doing the service. Yes?
Do you think that this is because of the person's feelings, like people will see it and then come away with a negative feeling, or because of the thing itself that, like, God is Shalem, so just, you know, describe God, but that, like, glory and majesty require that the person be whole and not have blemishes of whatever sort. So therefore, that the Kohanim that are acting in the temple may not have such a thing. Not because of how human perceives it, because of the thing must be that way.
I'm not sure, but remember the pasuk says, "Ve'et dakau shfal ruach." Hashem is with those that are humble. Hashem chose Moshe Rabbeinu, the most humble of men, the blemished brother, the one who could not speak clearly. So we have to remember that this does not reflect on Hashem's connection with these people. It reflects on a specific position. In that position, that's not where they should be. You come to majesty, you have to feel like you've come to majesty. The Kohanim are warned that when they deal with the holy sacrifices of the Jewish people, they have to be careful that some things, some sacrifices, they have no rights to. They have to be careful not to defile the sacrifices. If a person's defiled, if a person has come in contact with something that spiritually defiles them, they've come in contact with a corpse, etc., they have to do the process to purify themselves before they come back to the temple. A Kohen's servants are permitted to eat from their sacrifices. Depends which. A Kohen's daughter, when she marries out, so she loses her Kohen stature and she's not allowed to eat from the holy foods anymore. When she loses her husband, if she has no children, she comes back home, she becomes part of the family again. What happens if a person consumes holy foods by mistake? He has to pay back the value plus a fifth. How do you calculate a fifth? So let's say you ate something valued at 100 zuz. What's a fifth? You add how many?
25, right?
Oh. 20. So the question is, when the Torah uses the term fifth, does the Torah mean the way we would do math? You take 100, divide it by 5. 100 divided by 5 is? Is he right?
I think so, yeah.
Higher mathematics, guys. 100 divided by 5 is 20, right? Mm-hmm. So do you say you add a fifth, so that would mean 120, or do you say that when the Torah said add a fifth component, the Torah meant divide the principle, divide the number by 4, and add a fifth component that's equal to the first 4? When the Torah uses the term fifth, does it mean divide by 5, or does it mean add a fifth component equal to the first 4? And then you would divide 100 by 4.
25.
Thank you, 25. And then you would have to pay 125. So that you're adding a fifth component equal to the first 4. It's a question how we understand Torah terminology. We automatically think fifth means divide by 5. But fifth could also mean fifth component when you divide the original number by 4. That's the argument you find throughout Shas, whether you calculate milibar or milegav. Guys, you have to be open to new concepts. It's not the way we're thinking. It's a question of how was the Torah talking. Okay. I have a question. You're walking through the supermarket and your son says, "Dad, can I have that candy bar?" You look at it and it doesn't have a kosher symbol. Are you allowed to give it to him?
No.
No. Why not? But he's a child. Is he commanded to eat kosher? I'm asking, a child is 7 years old.
Rabbinically, he's obligated to keep kosher.
So Avi says, rabbinically, he's obligated to keep kosher. Let's ask another question. You're sitting at home, and you see your son on the webcam. You see him taking a chocolate bar that's not kosher. And then, he's by a friend, and he's waving to you on the Skype. And then you see his friend offers him a chocolate bar, and you say, "Hey, that's not kosher." And then the webcam dies, and your internet connection falls, and you try to Skype him, and he doesn't answer. Do you have to jump into the car, drive over to the kid's house, and say, "Son, don't eat that"? Is it your obligation or the kid's obligation? Who's obligated to keep kosher when a child's a minor?
Parent
or kid?
You don't keep obligations to
kids. Okay. So our parsha begins with the commandment of not becoming defiled. A kohen may not become defiled. The Torah says a kohen is responsible for his kids as well. Let's ask another question. It's broiling hot, and you forgot to turn on the fans. Are you allowed to take your son and ask him, "Son, you know what happens if you pull that string on the fan? Why don't we just see?"
You're talking about on Shabbat?
On Shabbat.
Right. People do this all the time, right?
Oh, but we say in Kiddush, who's going to rest? Ata ubincha, you and your son. Which son is the Torah talking about? If your son's already bar mitzvah, then when the Torah says ata, you, the Torah's talking to that son. The Torah's talking when it says ata, when the Torah gives us a commandment, it's talking to everyone over 13. So when the Torah says bincha, your son, which son is the Torah talking to?
The minor.
So then am I allowed to tell my 5-year-old, It's awful dark in here. Wouldn't it be nice if the light was... I wonder what would happen.
You're being suggestive. You're not,
okay, but let's say I'm not suggestive. So you're right. Suggestive is one level. What happens if I see him going to turn on the light? Am I supposed to stop him? So, we have three mitzvot where we are responsible for the children. We have three mitzvot. Eating kosher, Shabbat, and the mitzvah of a kohen, whose son, the Torah says in the beginning of our parasha, the adults have to watch the children, they shouldn't become defiled. So we have three mitzvot where the Torah obligates us. Other than that, like Avi said, we have a mitzvah of chinuch. We have to get them accustomed to keeping mitzvot. We get, rabbinically, we make them practice the mitzvot so that when they become an adult, they'll have the habits and then they'll do it. That's part of the mitzvah of chinuch. So, on the question of, is it my obligation or his? That's a machlokas Rashi Tosfos. Okay, back to our parsha. So a person buys a cat, and he doesn't want the cat to have more children. Is he allowed to neuter the cat?
No.
Why not?
Because it's the commandment to...
our parsha. Yafem. So in our parsha it says when you offer a sacrifice, don't offer an animal whose gonads have been mutilated. The Torah gives many descriptions. If they've been smashed, if they've been bashed, if they've been crushed, if they've been cut, right? Ma'uch, chatut, natuk, charut. Don't offer it as a sacrifice and don't do it in your land. So the Torah prohibits neutering. You're not allowed to...
Also from be fruitful and multiply, was that command was given also to the animals?
I'm unaware of anyone deriving it from there. So we have a...
How did that... That's for a specific case of a korban.
But then the Torah says, uve'artzechem lo ta'asu. And don't do it wherever you live. Okay, so that's an added commandment. People are sometimes unaware of it. Where this comes up is sometimes people work as scientists. And part of the job is when you're experimenting with animals, so very often you want to ensure that your experiment isn't affected by pregnancy. If the animal gets pregnant, that can throw off your experiment. So all the labs generally have one of the scientists whose responsibility it is to neuter all the animals they're working with. So you could run into that problem. Okay. We move on to the next mitzvah. When an animal is born, it has to stick around 7 days, and only from the 8th day onward may you sacrifice it as a korban. If you want to eat meat, you're allowed to sacrifice the baby the day it's born. You want to offer a sacrifice, you got to give it 7 days before the 8th day. What does this sound like? Where else do we wait for the 8th day? Brit Milah, correct. So in Brit Milah we say, what's this similar to? There was a king who wanted to honor his wife. So whoever wanted to meet with him, he'd say, you have to first see my queen, and after you see her, you could come see me. He wanted to give her a position. You had to go through her office before you could come see the king. So Hashem says, you want to see me? You have to see my queen, Shabbos, before you come to me. And that's the idea of a Shalom Zachar, where Ashkenazim have a custom when a male son is born. So we always say, before you do the circumcision, the first Friday night, he first has to go through a Friday night. Circumcision is on the 8th day, so he'll always run through a Friday night. He'll always have a Shabbos. And then we celebrate that first meeting of the child's soul with the queen, with the Shabbat. Circumcision is like a sacrifice. You guys know that, right? Okay. Wow. I never thought of that. Those who undergo Giyur really can think about that. Usually a baby has no idea what he's doing. But a person who's doing a circumcision as an adult can actually think about it, yeah. Because it says people try to be the tzaddik, the one who the baby's placed on, when they do the circumcision, because then he's like the altar. But the guy who's doing the circumcision himself, he gets to do even more than that, okay?
There's no tzaddiks for adults, I assume.
There is, if they want.
There's no what?
Tzaddiks for adults, so... I had a student once who asked me to put my hand under his head during his circumcision. He wanted me to be a tzaddik. And someone wanted to make money, so they developed a surgeon's table where the middle of the bench has a gap, and then you could sit there and put your lap, and they put down the bench, and so then the person is lying on your lap, so to speak,
during the time of the circumcision. So then they sell this. You're laughing, but being a sandik is a tremendous merit. So they developed this bench, this surgeon's bench, where you could actually buy the rights. The person can sell them to you to be a sandik.
Did they put out under?
Usually it is a local anesthetic when adults have a circumcision. But you should remember that in the days of the Talmud, they didn't have such good anesthesia. And
they just drank a lot.
They fainted. Yeah, it wasn't easy. Yeah. I'll tell you a quick story. We had a student here who practiced alternative medicine. And he told me that he was once on an island out in Greece, and he saw a person whose finger was infected and it was gangrene. So he told the guy, you got to go see a doctor. You have to get that amputated because your life's in danger. And the guy said, I can't get to a doctor. I don't have the money. I live on this island. We don't have any doctors. He said, you have to cut off that piece of the finger because you're going to die. There's no two ways about it. The gangrene is just going to spread and you're going to die. So the guy says, you learned medicine. So he says, I learned alternative medicine. He says, well, you can alternate as you cut off my finger.
You can alternate?
So, they took him, he told me this story. It was a big guy. They brought a lot of vodka, and he drank a lot of vodka. And after he drank a lot of alcohol, they tied him to a chair. And they brought three big guys who sat on him and held him down as he started the surgery. And he slowly started amputating that part of the finger. And he said at some point, the guy not only tried to jump out of the chair and fight everyone, but he yelled and then he fainted. So then he completed the surgery. Gave me an insight as to how they used to do this, right? He said he had three people hugging him and holding him and everything. He said the guy loves him. You know, he's like his best friend because he saved his life. They said at the time of the surgery, the guy was all over the place. So you're asking, you know, what they had back in the day. I don't know, because you have to remember that circumcisions used to involve a lot of cutting. Today, really? we do it pretty fast. In the days of the Talmud, they would do a circumcision like peeling an orange. It involved a lot of cutting. Man. It wasn't so simple, yeah. Wow. We've gotten better. Our system...
What? They didn't have such great knives or something?
Everything was, yeah. So our system is much better. Yeah, so it just gives you more appreciation. The Talmud says that one of the rabbis had his leg amputated, and his son was there, and he was a Kohen. And as they were amputating his leg, he told the surgeon, tell me when you reach the last sinews connecting my leg. And when they reached there, he told his son, son, leave the room. He had that presence of mind. He said, you're a Kohen. You're not allowed to be in the room. Once they finish amputating, severing my leg, that's a complete organ that defiles the room. So he told the surgeon, wait a second, don't finish amputating my leg. And he told his son, son, now you have to leave the room. So maybe they had better anesthesia, I don't know, but it doesn't seem that way from the Talmud. It seems like, wow, okay. That's okay, that's power.
I think like a lot more of the Western world and stuff like that, even converts, many of them would probably already be finished with that.
Okay, that's true. Okay, back to our parsha. So one of the halachic questions we have today, which we were lenient on, but it's a big question that came up, is with transplants. If you take an organ from a body, so then that organ defiles a person. So can a Kohen receive an organ because you're attaching to him something that would defile him? So obviously if he needs a liver or a kidney, so then his need for life overrides this mitzvah. But what happens if you're transplanting something else? What happens if the Kohen's own finger gets severed? So today they can reattach it. But technically, halachically, that severed finger is defiled. Now can you reattach it to the Kohen? So again, we're lenient, we permit it, but there's a broad halachic discussion as to how that works. Very often, if you have a tooth extracted and you want to implant a tooth,
So they put in tissue to give more body to the gums. Now that tissue is taken from dead people. You could get synthetic tissue, but it's not as good as real tissue. Is a kohen allowed to do that, or must he insist on synthetic tissue? So you see, this mitzvah of a kohen not becoming defiled can have many branches of halacha. Yes?
Is there an answer?
When you'll be a kohen, you'll find out. Yes?
Apart from the kohen themselves, was it the moment of the time of reading this part here now, did we even read about organs and open surgery, basically, on the organs?
What's the question?
Like fingers and limbs only. That we're thinking about here.
I didn't follow the question.
Did they attempt any kind of search at that point in time? Was there any kind of halachic principles given in this sense?
We have the halachot we just mentioned about severing organs. Other than that, I don't know. You know, the Talmud discusses how they would do brain surgery.
They would attempt brain surgery.
The Talmud says how to do it. The Talmud says there was some kind of disease where they would have a problem in the brain. And the Talmud discusses how you prepare a certain concoction that you give the person to drink. And then what you embalm. It says you have to embalm his head 300 times to soften the skull. And then it says how you have to take care as you cut open the skull. Because if you puncture the membrane, then the person's going to die. And you have to ensure that the disease doesn't cause to puncture the membrane. The Talmud discusses that, how they did, how they opened the skull and took out.
What you're saying about the what they put him to sleep with, I mean, like, I heard, you know, getting back to what we're talking about, amputation and all that kind of stuff, I heard that they had, you know, certain things that we don't know of today.
For sure.
For, like, you
for
know,
sure.
Pain.
The Talmud says that. The Talmud said they had anesthesias. Uh-huh. This alternate doctor didn't. I'm saying... But they did. They did. The Talmud says that's how we calculate the payment for pain. Mm-hmm. If a person pains someone else, so they have to pay for it. Meaning, let's say a person cut off someone's arm by mistake.
Yeah.
So he has to pay. Nezek tzar sheves ripui boshes. He has to pay five types of damages. One of them is he has to pay for the pain.
Uh-huh.
How do you calculate the pain? You calculate how much would a person pay the executioner if the king would rule that he has to have that arm cut off.
Uh-huh.
How much would he pay the executioner to get anesthesia while he's cutting off that arm? Would you pay $10,000? Would you pay $1 million? Would you pay $10 million? How much would you pay?
I guess it depends
on how much I have. Okay. Right. So learn. That's what we learn in the Chazon. You got to learn.
Uh-huh.
But in general, from there, you see they had anesthesia. Yes.
But I feel like I didn't ask the question probably before. Is there any kind of concept about organ not donation, but more like organs being swapped around, or
I don't know of it. I don't know of it. Could be. Nothing comes to mind.
Probably not.
Like that. We're up to Ravi. So now we come to the mitzvos of the holidays. Yes? So. Okay. First of all, holidays are called Moed. Moed can mean a set time. Moed could come from the word Vad. You guys know the Rebbe has a Hisvadus. What does the word Vad mean? Council, the Jewish people unite. So we have, I skipped the mitzvah, I'm sorry. Okay, so we'll get back to it in a second. We have the idea that on a holiday, families are supposed to unite. Yes, according to Nachmanides, it's a biblical mitzvah to daven in a minyan on Yamim Tovim, on holidays. But even if we don't go with Nachmanides, just the idea, you're supposed to be together with family. On Yom Tov, it's a time of Moed, get together. So that's one of the pluses of marrying into a family here in Israel. You get a family. Mm-hmm. Now, for some people, that's not the recommendation. Sometimes it's better to marry someone who has a similar experience to yourself because you'll understand one another more. But there is a plus to having family. We skip, just before Ravi, we have the important mitzvah of Chilul Hashem and Kiddush Hashem. It says, don't desecrate my name and sanctify my name. So the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem is, what does Kiddusha mean? Kiddusha means separate. What is Chilul? Chilul is defilement. It's no different than anything else. So when a person has a mitzvah and he's in the presence of other people and he shows them that he values that mitzvah and it's unique in his life, that's Kiddush Hashem. He shows, look, what Hashem says is important to me. It's different than everything else. That's a Kiddush Hashem. You look at it and you see that. So we think of Kiddush Hashem as someone who says, I will not bow to the idol. You could kill me and I won't bow to the idol. And they bring him up there and they cock the gun, they put it at his head and they say, bow to the idol or we'll kill you. And he says, no. And then they pull the trigger. So we think that's Kiddush Hashem. Well, it is, right. He's shown that Hashem's word is more holy than anything else and unique, and he's willing to give up his life for it. So that's the ultimate Kiddush Hashem. But you know what? Any mitzvah that we do in public, what we're showing is the word of Hashem is unique to us. So Kiddush Hashem is when we're standing in the presence of 10 Jews, and in the presence of 10 Jews, we show that Hashem's word is unique. Chilul Hashem is when we're standing in the presence of 10 Jews, and we show that the word of Hashem is not so important to us. So there's a line at the supermarket, and a guy cuts the line, and they tell him, excuse me, sir, but there's a line. And he says, tell someone else, I'm not interested. So he's standing there with a yarmulke and tzitzis, and they look at him, and they say, don't you respect the mitzvot? And he says, leave me alone. Wait, so he's not respecting, but he's not respecting in public. So that's a chilul Hashem. He's desecrated the mitzvot in front of other people. So chilul Hashem is when I'm standing in the presence of 10 Jews, and a person has shown that the mitzvot are not unique. The word of Hashem is not unique. Those are the two sides of the coin. Now, what happens if a person is alone in the room and he has this tremendous desire to click on that button and he knows he shouldn't be looking at those pictures? He shouldn't be clicking on that button. He should shut that screen. He should walk away from that computer. No one's looking. He's gone, what do they call that in Chrome? On what's that mode where no one can see what you've done? Incognito. So no one's going to see his history, right? No one knows what he's doing there. So he's incognito mode. He's alone in the house. The door's locked. He's there. It's only him. Ah, no, there isn't. There's the Rabban Shlom there. Says the Rambam, when he walks away and he does that mitzvah, no one knows about it other than the Rabban Shlom. That's also a Kiddush Hashem. Because what he's shown at that minute is the word of Hashem is unique. And no one has to know whether I did it or didn't do it. But I walked away because in my mind, what Hashem says is different. So that's also Kiddush Hashem. It's not a chilul Hashem if you don't do it. I don't know. I hear you. That's a good point.
But does it have to be 10? Does it have to be 10?
No. So that's what the Rambam's telling us, that sometimes you can have a Kiddush Hashem that's chilul Hashem. I don't remember.
Why does it have to be
10? Right. He's saying,
Right.
So that's a Kiddush Hashem b'Rabim, and that's a Kiddush Hashem without Rabim, and that's a Chilul Hashem b'Rabim and not Rabbi Rabim, right? When a person willfully transgresses, that's a Chilul Hashem, even if there aren't Rabim, right? That's b'Rabim and that's not. That's why it says, "V'nikdashti b'toch b'nei Yisrael." And from here we learn another important halacha, that when we're doing things of holiness, we need 10 Jews. So if you want to say Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu, what's Baruch Hu is Hashem Amvorach? You're sanctifying Hashem's name, right? You're saying to everyone else, bless Hashem who is blessed. So that's, you're sanctifying Hashem's name. So you need 10 Jews present, right? This is one of the challenges that people sometimes have in the gear process. No one knows that they're not yet Jewish. And then they count them for a minyan. So it can be a little uncomfortable. So you know, you have to think in advance. If you're not going to tell people that you're not yet Jewish, so avoid such situations. Sometimes people will notify before they come for Shabbos that they haven't yet finished their gear process. It's a good idea, because otherwise they want to count you for a zimun. You need 3 to do a zimun, and then it's uncomfortable for everyone around. What happens if they pull out wine that's not cooked? So it's up to the person to know that he's not supposed to touch that wine, but it can be very uncomfortable when they pass the bottle around, or they ask him, could you pass me that bottle? And if he didn't tell them, so he could be stuck in a quandary. So sometimes it's recommended to inform the host. It saves everyone embarrassing situations. That does not mean that after a person converted, it's recommended to publicize it, because even though technically by publicizing it, one should get many benefits, because we have many mitzvot to give perks to ger, that doesn't mean that everyone is learned enough to behave that way. Sometimes people do not live up to that ideal, and especially people who are not learned, And that's why it's not always recommended after one finishes their gear to go telling everyone, because you never know who's going to be that boor who doesn't know the mitzvah and halachot, and they might not necessarily give nice treatment just because they don't know. So back to our mitzvah. So Kiddush Hashem will include those situations like saying Kaddish. People sometimes say, I don't want to say Kaddish. Why? You're saying Kaddish, you're doing the biblical mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. That's why the Mishnah Brura writes, when you're in shul, even if you're not standing for the Torah reading, but when the person goes up to the Torah and says, Baruch Hu Hashem Amvorach, so you're actively participating in the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, you should stand up. Right? Okay, so, yes, Yaakov.
What about public appearance?
That has nothing to do, that's any three people. Once there are three people, that's public.
Three people? I think so.
Okay. We'll move forward. So we have the holidays. The first holiday is Pesach. Gentlemen, I strongly recommend give yourself a challenge, take a Jewish calendar, learn the months by heart, and learn what holiday is in which date of the month. You want to start getting a picture of Judaism, you got to work on getting your basic knowledge in Judaism in line. So what holiday is in Sivan, the month of Sivan?
Shavuot.
Which day in Sivan?
Sixth
of Sivan. Okay. What holiday is in Tevet? The month of Tevet. So Hanukkah ends in Tevet. Hanukkah begins in Kislev and ends in Tevet. You got to learn the calendar, learn the months, and I recommend that at the top of your papers, you should write the Jewish month, the Jewish date. I always like writing the Jewish date on checks. Here in Israel, legally, they have to accept the check with the Jewish date. So even though in the stub, I write the Gregorian date, because on the computer, when you want to check when a check was made, it's telling you the Gregorian date. But on the check itself, I write the Jewish date. Just be careful, because if you're going to write Rosh Chodesh, Reish Chet, so the clerk might think it says Chaf Chet, and then they won't cash the check. Reish Chet is very often the acronym we use for Rosh Chodesh, so it's not a good idea. Write the first of the month of Kislev Tevet Shvat, etc. Yes?
Why did the Rambam say it's a mitzvah on Yom Tov?
It's biblical. Nachmanides says it's biblical on Yom Tov. Okay, so we have the holiday of Pesach. We have the sacrifices of Pesach. And then we have the mitzvah of Omer. What's the mitzvah of Omer? Omer, we're counting the Omer. What's the Omer? So Omer is a volume measurement. We have a mitzvah the morning after the first day of Pesach. We bring the first sacrifice. We take an Omer, that volume of barley. We harvest it even if it's Shabbos. And we bring a sacrifice, and that's the first harvest. After that, you harvest all the new crops. Before that, you can't harvest. After you've harvested the barley, you may harvest all the new crops, the new wheat, the new grains, wheat, yeah. And then we count from that sacrifice, right? So that was a biblical mitzvah in the time of the temple. And today, according to most opinions, it's not biblical. Any Hasidim in class? No Hasidim, okay. Nusach Sfard in class? So that's a big question about the Nusach Sfard that says, Inni muchan umzuman l'kayim mitzvah saseh. I'm prepared to do the biblical proactive commandment. So that's a big question. How can you say it's a biblical commandment? Today it's a rabbinic commandment. So you could ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Okay, we're up to Chamishi. We have the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah, and we have the mitzvah of blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah, right? Then we have the mitzvah of Yom Kippur. And what mitzvah do we have on Yom Kippur? What don't we do on Yom Kippur? We don't eat, we don't drink. What else don't we do on Yom Kippur? We don't wash, anoint ourselves. What else don't we do on Yom Kippur? No relations, right? What else don't we do on Yom Kippur? We don't wear leather shoes, and we don't do work. Now, the Torah says whoever does not afflict himself on this day will be cut off. Do all five go under the heading of inui, affliction? So it's a big machlokas. The Talmud says all five, and there's a big question among the commentaries, are all five biblical? Because it says that a king is allowed to wash his face, And a bride, the first month after marriage, is allowed to wash herself because we're trying to promote the relationship between them. So that certainly seems to indicate that it's not biblical. So we assume that eating and drinking are biblical, even a minute amount, right? Even a small amount of eating and drinking is biblically prohibited. So people sometimes think, I'll just take a drop of water. No, 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 that's biblically prohibited. If a person has a medical need, they should ask their local Orthodox rabbi. Obviously, we don't want people to get endangered. But even the smallest amount of eating and drinking is prohibited biblically on Yom Kippur. The other forms of inui we generally assume are rabbinic. The Torah says, when is Yom Kippur? On which day is Yom Kippur? Which day of the month of Tishrei? 10th. Right, yes. The 10th of Yom Kippur. So the Torah says, from the 9th at night to the 10th at night. 2 days we fast, right? Everyone knows on Yom Kippur we fast 2 days, right? No. Are we awake? Yes? No. We fast for 1 day. So why does the Torah describe it as 2 days? So from there we derive there is a mitzvah to eat on the 9th and fast on the 10th. And the Torah describes it as a 2-day fast to tell us that if you eat properly on the 9th to prepare for the 10th, Hashem will consider it as though you had a mitzvah and complied and fasted 2 days.
When you said cut off, you mean karet?
Correct. And if you want to know what karet is, ask on Thursday night. Children, so when they get close to bar mitzvah age, we let them start practicing. Depends on how old they are. Sometimes we tell them, wait another hour till you eat your meal. Sometimes we say, eat lunch, skip breakfast. Depends on the age of the child. Depends on the health of the child. You know, there are different customs, whether a year beforehand or 3 fasts beforehand. Many people will fast the 3 fasts prior to their bar mitzvah. They already fast the complete fast. But they slowly build up to it. To my little kids, I always tell them, you're fasting between meals. You'll eat dinner and you'll fast till breakfast. And they're very happy with that. But as they grow up, so, you know, if a kid ate a big dinner before Yom Kippur, it's not such a big deal to push off breakfast. When they're late for the bus, they skip breakfast. Right? They run out and say, I'll catch lunch. So on Yom Kippur, they can't wait to lunch. It depends on the health of the child and the age of the child. Okay, we have the mitzvah of Sukkot. What mitzvah do we have on Sukkot? Okay, we're supposed to be in a sukkah. In order for a sukkah to be kosher, the main thing is the schach. You need 3 kosher walls, which is much more simple, but the schach has to be kosher. So that you got to follow the halachot on that. What else? You said lulav. So we take the species, which are what? A lulav. You got to get a kosher lulav. You take what else? 3 hadasim, where the hadasim, what are they called in English? Myrtle branches. You try to get branches where most of the branch, the 3 leaves come out of the same line. You could draw a line and all 3 leaves come out of the same level. And arava, what is an arava? So they say willow. I don't think arava is a willow. I think it's a different species. I don't think it's actually a willow. You take an arava, and ideally you should take an arava that the top tip is not cut off, that the top tip has leaves coming out of it. So we have the 4 species, and what's an esro called in English?
Citron.
Citron, okay. So when we take an etrog, we try to take a beautiful etrog. Most etrogim you get today are good. You should buy an etrog with a heksher. I used to learn in Chinatown, and the Chinese brought in these big lemons sukkah time. They tried to sell them as etrogim. Okay, so a lemon is not an etrog. How is an etrog different than a lemon? Number one, a lemon has primarily juice and very little rind, very little white. An etrog has most rind and very little juice. Number two, the seeds of a lemon are interspersed throughout the lemon. The seeds of an etrog go in a line around the rind. Number 3, a lemon has a very small tip, and an etrog has a large tip. Number 4, on the bottom, the stem where it connects to the tree, a lemon protrudes, and an etrog is indented. Number 6, a lemon is smooth on the outside, and an etrog is bumpy on the outside. And number 7, a lemon has a very specific taste, and an etrog, if you know how to eat it, is going to have a very sweet taste. Number 8, a lemon falls off the tree when the time comes and is a very healthy plant. Etrog is a very delicate plant, and it could stay on the tree from year to year, continuing to grow. Our etrogim don't have all these qualities, but the Yemenite ones do. And number 9 or 10, wherever we're up to, is that the leaves of an etrog tree have the same flavor, not only smell, as an etrog, the leaves and the branches, whereas a lemon doesn't really have that quality. So those are many hallmarks that are different than a lemon. The prime thing that we need is that someone who has a tradition that says this is an etrog is selling us that etrog. And we're out of time. I'll see you.